Blog Talk Radio.
We saw a movie by that he had put together, and
around for about 6 or 8 months in our area, and couldn't figure it out. And until we saw it, but and you didn't know what it was either.
I just knew that something was wrong, because this was even before I met you, that I knew that the winters were not, that the skies didn't seem as bright, and I didn't really think that much of it. I just said, oh, it just doesn't seem as bright as it used to be. And that's when John pointed that out to me. He said, you've got to look up and see what's happening in the sky. And it was only when I really caught...
You noticed that in 2000?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that in 2000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And because I spent a lot of time outside, especially in the summer, and I had been doing cross-country skiing and things, and I just kind of noticed that it just wasn't as sparkly bright as it used to be in the winter. Many times in the winter you would have a big snowstorm, and then the sky would be very, very bright. It would be so bright that you couldn't possibly keep your eyes open unless you had sunglasses on.
It used to be like that even in 2001, around here, it was very clear. And then it started that, then I started seeing those chemtrails all over the place. I started seeing the strange patterns, and I started to wonder, is this a military operation, or how could...
Well, anyway,
like
we met John Brennan, and he was the one that told us what it was, and clarified it for us and helped us understand it all. And then we also came into contact with Keith Harmon Snow, and Keith had written several articles
Keith
on that.
Keith wrote it in 2001 when he wrote that Out of the Blue.
Mm-hmm.
Or whether it's a weapon, and we got introduced to this early on, and have been fighting it the best we could, at least trying to inform people, you know, since then. And so tonight, keeping in that tradition, we're going to do it again.
So to keep us all informed, we need to be, so that we can bring it up with our representatives and let them know how unhappy we are about it, because we never got a chance to vote on it or okay it or be told about it. It's just being done to us.
No, it's
without our consent.
And tonight you'll get a lot of information on that at 9:30. But in the meantime, I wanted to start off with we're also, Lila, being the president of her union,
mm-hmm.
AFSCME union, which is a public
employee. A local.
Local, yeah. What's happening out in Wisconsin is very, very important to us, and we're very concerned as to what's going on. But the more we see, the more disgusting this whole thing is, and what they're trying to do to the public workers. And here's an
to the residents of that state. It's not just to the public workers. There's all kinds of things in this bill.
Right.
And the name of this article is Hidden Provisions in Wisconsin Bill. On February 25th, AP said that the Wisconsin Assembly, after days of debate, passed Walker's contentious bill, but the standoff is far from over. Senate Democrats remain absent in Illinois, vowing to resist ending collective bargaining rights for public workers. So far, Walker won't compromise, so resolution is on hold. Much more, however, is at issue. On February 24th, economist and the New York Times columnist Paul Krugman headlined Shock Doctrine USA, saying, "What's happening in Wisconsin is a power grab, an attempt to exploit the fiscal crisis to destroy the last major counterweight to the political power of corporations and the wealthy. It involves much more than union busting, bad as that is. Hidden in the bill's 144 pages are extraordinary things, including a provision letting Walker appoint a health czar to make draconian health care cuts to Wisconsin's poor and low-income households unilaterally."
Another one states 16.896, I don't know what that is, sale or contract. Oh, that's the number.
That's the bill.
That's the bill.
Mm-hmm. 16.896 is the bill, and then it says sale or contractual operation of state-owned.
That's the paragraph.
Yeah, of state-owned heating, cooling, and power plants. Notwithstanding 1348 and blah blah blah, the department may sell any state-owned heating, cooling, and power plant, or may contract with a private entity for the operation of such a plant without a solicitation of bids. In other words, this is a closed contract.
And for any amount that the department determines to be in the best interest of the state, and notwithstanding, no approval or certification of the Public Service Commission is necessary for a public utility to purchase or contract for the operation of such a plant, and any such purchase is considered to be in the public interest and to comply with the criteria for certification of project under 1949, blah, blah, blah.
In but, other words, they can sell...
Without permission by the...
elected or representatives have no say in this, and they can decide who they want to give it to or rent it to or lease it to, and...
With no bid.
Call it the Koch brothers provision. Multi-billionaire owners of Koch Industries, an industrial giant heavily invested in energy and power-related enterprises. According to Wisconsin campaign finance filings, Koch Industries PAC contributed $43,000 to Walker's gubernatorial campaign, second only to the $43,125 given by state housing and realtor groups. Moreover, the Koch PAC helped Walker and other Republicans by contributing $1 million to the Republican Governors Association. That, in turn, spent $65,000 to support Walker and $3.4 million on television attack ads and mailings against his opponent, Milwaukee Democratic Mayor Tom Barrett. It made the difference between victory and defeat. Republican outspent Democrats, sweeping many of the candidates to victory last November.
Significance of the contentious provision. Wisconsin owns dozens of small power plants, mostly of government facilities and University of Wisconsin infrastructure. The bill let Walker privatize them under no-bid contracts, claiming it serves the public interest. Opinions differ on the provision's significance, and the Wisconsin Electric Cooperative Association, David Hoopman, sees no private enterprise bonanza. Executive Director Charles said, saying that the state-owned plants are old, coal-fired, and heading toward failing to comply with environmental requirements. Others have already done so. And the Customers First Coalition, however, wrote Walker seeing a more thorough evaluation of the value of the state power assets and a comparison of whether state or private ownership is in the best interest of the taxpayer, as well as more time for debate.
You know darn well that once it goes to private interest, what's going to cost the taxpayer is going to be a huge amount.
Exactly. And, I mean, they're going to expect the taxpayer to foot the bill, and they're going to get root the profit.
Yeah, this is another Enron deal.
Yeah.
Whoever's right, letting the governor use no-bid contracts to sell state assets raises serious red flag issues. If the above provision wasn't important, why was it included? And what does Koch expect for contributing? For sure, much more than it gave Krugman, put it this way. Union busting and privatization remain GOP priorities, and the party will continue its efforts to smuggle them through in the name of balanced budgets. Other reasons, or none at all, aiming straight at the heart of the democratic freedoms affecting everyone directly or indirectly. Let me tell you this, you Republicans and conservatives, it's going to affect your bottom line, because you're going to be paying a hell of a lot more for your power.
And if you think you're exempt because you're a Republican, you're a complete and utter idiot.
Unless you're a wealthy Republican.
Even if you're a wealthy Republican, you're a complete and utter, even greater idiot. All right? So may your money be deflated, and may your assets be burned.
For 20 minutes, vlogger Ian Murphy fooled him, recording his provocative comments so we know. They included possible bogus felony charges against absent Democratic senators, as well as consideration given to planting some troublemakers among protesters to blame them. He also praised one of Ronald Reagan's most defining moments when he fired the air traffic controllers. Moreover, he told his cabinet that today's confrontation in our time to change the course of history, implying, of course, his intent to crush unionism in Wisconsin. Stripping public workers of all rights, including decent pay and benefits, as well as the right to bargain collectively
He's a little freaking Hitler, you know. That's
for
what
better
he is.
One.
He's a little Hitler.
So this is a Coke pretender, interrupts Walker.
Yeah.
He also threatened to fire 12,000 state workers without passage of his overhaul bill, saying, I'll do almost anything to avoid laying people off. We need to avoid those layoffs for the good of those workers, but we'll do it anyway to show toughness, to impress top Republican leaders and funders like the Koch brothers.
Jesus.
In so doing, he's at odds with 200 state mayors, school board presidents, and other officials opposing eliminating collective bargaining rights. Walker, however, is hard-lined against any changes to his bill. His comment about Reagan is telling, wanting, in fact, to harm workers the way he did to all organized labor nationally. When he took office, union membership was around 24%. When he left, it was 16.8, two-thirds of its former self and headed lower. The latest January 2011 Bureau of Labor Statistics, in fact, shows 11.9% of workers organized nationally, only 6.9% of private sector ones heading for oblivion if what's going on isn't halted. This is one of organized labor's last stand. Wisconsin is ground zero. As it goes, so goes America. So it's crucially important to resist, stay resolute, stand fast, and refuse to surrender rights too important to lose. It's their call and our obligation to support them. And this article was by Stephen Lendman. He lives in Chicago and can be reached at his email.
You can get to it by going to, unfortunately, you know, you got to go out of the country, Ukrnet.info.
His name is Stephen Lendman.
Ukrnet.info. And check that out because it's really staggering what's going on there. In fact, I'd like to post that. I find that everything that I do nowadays,
mm-hmm. So you're gonna post that on Facebook so people can read it if they want
right,
to.
Right. Because that way, I find that what
I'm sure there are a lot of people that would
is Walker.
around the Capitol on a scale of last Saturday's peak crowd of an estimated 68,000 could swell even more for 3 p.m. I don't know. So there were a lot of people there.
Yeah. 100,000 Americans around the country marched on government as an event that would be a perfect fit for the 24-hour cable news cycle. Even better, the protests were occurring during the news cycle dead zone of Saturday afternoon. The coverage should have been everywhere in the media, but if you turned on your television in hopes of watching the rally for Wisconsin Live, you were disappointed. And as the official state-run television of the Republican Party, Fox News, has been openly and loudly supporting Governor Walker, it is no surprise that the right-wing network would ignore the events in Madison and around the country today. And a propaganda outlet never spends much time relaying information that is detrimental to their message.
CNN, which is supposed to be the moderate network in the cable news ideological spectrum, sort of thought they should cover the story, so they did for a few minutes and a half. And half live cut in here and there. No wall-to-wall coverage, of course, but they at least managed to pull themselves away from celebrating the Tea Party long enough to take a quick glance at Madison. Now we come to MSNBC, the so-called liberal news network. MSNBC couldn't be bothered to wake away from their lockup and Dateline reruns documentary block to cover a landmark event that has reunified the left and is likely to have an impact on the 2012 presidential election.
Of course they would. MSNBC is a joke to all liberals. I mean, if you watch that piece of crap show, you know, they're all monkeys. They're all monkeys. They're all bought and sold. And now we come to, if there is one network that progressive liberals thought understood this, it was MSNBC. However, MSNBC has never really been overtly interested in covering the news, much less live news events on a weekend. If I had a dollar for every time MSNBC had disappointed their viewerships by being AWOL when news happened, I'd be a very wealthy man. The only thing I can say for their favor, and it's very little, once they threw Ed Schultz, Mr. Union, they knew this was coming.
Yeah.
They saw it and they threw Mr. Ed Schultz
to 10 o'clock,
okay, and put some dumb shit on it at 7 o'clock. Okay, so now what they got is, and they did have Wisconsin coverage there,
mm-hmm.
All right, but nobody was watching, all right? I mean, nobody watches 10 o'clock MSNBC.
No.
I mean, nobody. I mean, that's after Oberman was out. He couldn't even be put in Oberman's place. So nobody, they don't want a liberal audience. I mean, you got to remember, MSNBC.
Well, it doesn't represent their interests, their corporation.
No, but MSNBC is NBC, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Microsoft, okay? Microsoft NBC, everyone forgets that, all right? And the problem with that is that these guys don't want any kind of real news out there, all right? It's a globalist. You know,
well, they're corporations. They only want profit.
Yeah, so
all three cable networks share something else in common besides their decision to ignore today's rallies. CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, along with most other forms of media, have decided that liberal protests aren't newsworthy. They believe that their ratings and the money are in the right, not the left. The three cable networks are corporate-owned and only for the purpose of profit. They don't care about journalism or their obligation to inform
and,
the public.
And never forget that they fired Donahue, Phil Donahue,
mm-hmm.
right before the war, right? Because he was too liberal.
And he was too popular, right?
And he wasn't liberal. He wasn't really. He was the only guy who was giving a right and left look
mm-hmm.
view of the war. But they still fired his butt, and they never rehired him. And he got blackballed throughout the whole
all the media.
Yeah, because he was a liberal, all right? And so up yours, MSNBC, if you think you got anything worthwhile.
So
this is all about the dollars and the outdated notion
that the most profitable way to run a cable news outlet is to be like Fox, which is why CNN keeps hiring more and more right-wingers and has hopped into bed with the Tea Party Express.
And CNN is owned by Ted Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted Turner said to kill all the useless feeders.
That would include liberals.
That was, well, he's considered a liberal.
Mm.
He considers himself a liberal.
Mm.
He married Jane Fonda.
She divorced him.
Yeah, but she divorced him because she became a born-again Christian.
After being married to him.
He couldn't handle that. But there is a deeper bias evident in the case of the Wisconsin rallies. The corporate ownership of these networks, like most businesses, is anti-union. They assume that all of America is also anti-union, and they have conveniently ignored all the pollings that show that American people are behind the protesters in order to rationalize ignoring the protests.
The networks assume that since there is no money to be made by covering the left, America isn't interested in events like protests in Madison. At least that is what they tell themselves in order to justify their own biases in filtering out the news. The problem is that when the cable networks stay stuck in their old model and ignore these stories, new media steps up to fill the void. Today's generation of internet news viewers and tweeters are tomorrow's would-be cable news viewers. If cable news insists on imposing their myopic definition of news, their viewers may not be tuning in.
And you know what? There's less than, CNN doesn't even get that many viewers. MSNBC gets fewer viewers. They don't even get a million viewers a day. You know, nobody watches that crap. And Fox News gets about 3 million, 4 million. You know, they get 20-25% share. But the others get the rest. And there's only 28% of all people in this country get their news from those stations, from the networks.
That's true.
Okay, everybody else gets it from the internet.
Let me just finish up. By focusing on misguided cash grab, corporate cable news is sowing the seeds of its own stagnation. A protest was held today that was bigger than anything that the Tea Party has ever done, but you wouldn't know it if you were watching TV. There is something seriously wrong with the news gathering and reporting apparatus that devotes more live coverage to the protests in Egypt than protests in Wisconsin. Egypt was a big story, but the fight for the very survival of the middle class should not be ignored.
Cable news, your bias is showing. And that was from Politicus Sousa.
Politicus USA.
Oh, Politicus USA.
Right?
Yeah, Politicus, Politic Us USA.
Uh-huh.
All together. So, anyway, good article. We've got our guest is going to be coming up pretty soon. Our special guest is Jan Bonaiuto. And Jan has been a friend of ours for a number of years, but she is a peace advocate, activist, and she's setting up a rally here in Connecticut, on March 20th, Saturday, and we're looking forward to attending that. But
it's actually a Sunday?
Or a Sunday.
It's March 20th, Sunday, in Litchfield, Connecticut, on the green.
It's a large green, and well,
can hold a lot of
people. Anywhere are welcome to join us. But it's keeping in tradition of what there used to be a prior to Obama becoming elected, there used to be a regular turnout there on the green every Sunday to protest the war and protest Bush and conservatives and everything else. But then once Obama came in, it seemed like everybody stopped. And so did the anti-war movement stop, okay? And she's going to talk about that tonight and hopefully regenerate some excitement to our listeners to join in their local peace groups or join our local peace group.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so I think she's with us now.
Hello, Jan. Are you with us?
Hi, Leo. Hi, Lila.
Hey, good evening. How are you this evening?
I'm great. It's good to hear you and both in such fine form here on Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, thank you very much. We were just telling the folks that are listening about the rally that's being scheduled in Litchfield on March 20th, Sunday at noontime, and that there was a fine tradition of people who turned out weekly to protest the war and other issues that they felt were important. And then once Obama became elected, people kind of took a back step and didn't come out on the green anymore. And you, along with others, are trying to revitalize that. Is that true, Janet?
That's correct. We kind of decided that when Obama was elected, we were going to give him a little breathing room and see what he was going to do, if he was going to keep all the promises that he made during his campaign, which was to end the wars, to you know, to keep the money home for the people of this country. And he has done nothing of that. We're so upset that, you know, this war is just the same as George Bush's war. As a matter of fact, we call it the Bush-Obama war now. It's just continuing on and on. The money is going to foreign countries to blow up people and, you know, foreign homes, and nothing is happening in the United States to help the people. We are just.
Do you know, Jen, that they're actually the Obama is actually preparing a Libyan invasion. We're going to read that article tonight. We just didn't have time yet, but
right.
I mean, he's actually planning to invade Libya now.
Right.
Right? They already have, actually. I mean, so is Britain and a few other.
We can hardly wait to get those oil wells in the. I think it's in the eastern part of Libya.
Yeah, that's where that's liberated so far, but now.
Right.
Hey, it's such an incredible joke, isn't it?
Tell us a little bit about who's helping you organize this and how you're going about doing it.
Well, we made a lot of contacts in the 5 years that we stood on the green, and we keep in touch with these people on a regular basis. And so Mario and Dorothea DeCecco were people. Mario would stand out there every day of the week. He would be out there with a sign. He's a retired person, and Dorothea has a TV show that, you know, kept going after Obama was elected also. So people have been involved, but we decided to kind of give it a break for a while. But we just can't help but be inspired by what's going on in Wisconsin and all over the country in
the world, you know.
Yeah. Right, exactly. In Egypt and Libya, you know, they have a lot to teach us, I guess, is what it's
like. Yeah, well, we have a lot to remember.
Yeah.
I don't think we forgot. We just got lazy because, you know, all of this has been happening. I mean, people, I know you felt this way too, but at first I trusted Obama would do something right.
Right.
It turns out Obama has done everything wrong and continues to do that. And it's time now and he's turned against the left. He's turned against us. And even to the extent of calling us names, I'm sorry that I voted for the guy. And not that McCain would have been a better choice, but I would have almost preferred not to have voted in that election rather than to, be so disappointed with this guy, you know,
right.
And knowing it's a sellout. Don't you feel naive? Probably not anymore.
Well, I didn't vote for Obama and I didn't vote for McCain. I voted for the Green Party candidate, Cynthia McKinney, because I felt she was, of the three, she was the best choice. I have no belief anymore in the two-party system. As a matter of fact, I believe it's a bane to our democracy to have this two-party, which is really only a one-party system. They're not different in any way, although they want us to believe that they are. And all that the two parties do is to keep we the people at each other's throats.
That's right.
They figured out a way to divide and conquer us, and it's with the two party system. I just don't have any respect for Democrats or Republicans at all. So I don't know that I'm naive. I think I've lost that naivety a long time ago. But I do feel that we just need a paradigm shift in this country. We need to have more people running from third parties that, you know, don't have any ties to the mainstream political machine.
It's very, very difficult to make any inroads on the federal level in Washington.
Right.
I mean, they're so bought and sold by corporations. And corporations, of course, with the Supreme Court ruling, have the same status as a person. And how do you compete with that?
Exactly.
So, I know that you had some statistics you were going to show, going to talk about tonight, war casualties and just the overall devastation that's happened
because
in the last 10 years from this Bush and Obama insanity.
Right.
Maybe you can say those to us.
Okay, if I could read just a short paragraph. Chris Hedges wrote an article called No Other Way Out. He posted it on Common Dreams, it's a very short paragraph, but it kind of brings it home what we are doing in these wars. We are wasting $700 million a day to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, while our teachers, firefighters, and police lose their jobs, while we slash basic assistance programs for the poor, children, and the elderly, while we turn our backs on the some three million people being pushed from their homes by foreclosures and bank repossessions, and while we do nothing to help the 1 in 6 American workers who cannot find work. These wars have taken hundreds of thousands of lives. They've pushed millions into refugee or displacement camps. They have left young men and women severely crippled and maimed. They have turned our nation into an isolated pariah, fueling the very terrorism we seek to defeat. And they cannot be won. The sooner we leave Iraq and Afghanistan, the sooner we will save others and finally save ourselves. That's kind of the human toll that these wars have taken. But in dollar amounts, I went to a very good website that the American Friends put out, and they have broken it down that the war in only Iraq, not Afghanistan included, is costing the American taxpayers $500,000 a minute, or $720 million a day. And so for one day in Iraq, we could keep 6,400 families in their homes instead of being foreclosed upon. We could build 84 new elementary schools. This is just one day in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We could send college students with a 4-year scholarship. We could give 35,000 4-year scholarships to college students. We could pay for 12,000 elementary school teachers. Again, this is just one day in Iraq. That's what it cost us. And they go on to, you know, say that we could retrofit 1 million homes with renewable energy, or have 95,000 Head Start children in Head Start programs.
There's so much we could do, just so much.
Just one day of Iraq cost.
But then you wouldn't be able to funnel the money into GE. The money wouldn't be funneled into
Lockheed Martin, General Electric, the United Technologies, and
the security firm.
Halliburton. Kellogg Brown
and Root.
All of these crooks. It's just amazing. And, it's
Blackwater Security.
You got any chance? I was keeping up on it for a while, but I kind of lost count. Was the death tolls now, just the American death tolls for Iraq and and for Afghanistan.
Right, right. Well, as you remember, you might remember Lieutenant General Tommy Franks, when he was overseeing the war in Iraq, he told us that we just don't do body counts, right? It somehow
right.
didn't matter to him. But the last count that I saw was for Iraq was 4,757 of our soldiers dead. For Afghanistan, it was 2,352. And they do not even keep track of the wounded because there are, you know, there are so many wounded.
Well, and you know, the other thing is they don't count, they only count American casualties if they die
in Iraq. They
right.
don't count the ones that die when they're in the hospital back
That's
here.
That's right. And
right.
there were in 2009, which was, I think, the last year I was keeping track of it, we had over 60,000, actually 60,000, okay, people that had died.
As a result.
60,000, okay?
Wow. That's amazing.
Right. Yeah, American soldiers. And but those were the people that died of wounds, but then later they died in Germany or they died here,
mm-hmm.
You know, within weeks or months, actually, from being blown up, you know, or being shot. But
right.
they immediately rushed them out of Iraq and into German hospitals or into other hospitals.
So they're not counted.
And then they don't count them.
Right.
And then if you go to iraqbodycount.org, they're trying to keep a tally, but I believe they're falling short because they're way short now from other accounts. But they were showing 100,000 Iraqis have actually been killed.
Exactly.
That's bizarre because that's very low. But there are other accounts that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed.
Right.
And over 3 million. And that was, again, in 2009, I heard these figures, or 2010, actually, last year.
Right.
That over 3 million Iraqis were refugees, right?
That's
and,
what I heard, too, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, Dalia Wasi, who's an Iranian advocate, and we've had her on our show, and I hope to have her on again soon. She's been keeping. She's an Iranian, who's American Iraqi, who has actually been advocating the Iraqi cause, Iraqi people,
yeah.
And she's gone with tremendous toll things. Like for instance, they still don't have adequate water, and infrastructures haven't been built. They're still. Worried about. We don't hear about this anymore, you know.
You think we weren't even at war there.
No.
That's right.
I mean, we don't even hear about it anymore. And it's never in the news. You never hear about Iraq in the news anymore, in the mainstream.
That's right. News.
And even the websites aren't doing much on Iraq.
That's right.
I mean, we're supposed to be withdrawing from there, but I mean, what I heard last month, I believe, was like there were over 30 or 40 people that just got blown up, that died in Iraq from one suicide bomber, all right? And we're still fighting that war with the Shiites and the Sunnis.
Mm-hmm.
We're still there.
Exactly.
You know?
Although I have been hearing, well, I listen to a lot of progressive radio stations, and I have been hearing that they are being empowered by what is happening in Egypt and Libya, and they are really starting to surround their government buildings and demand that they...
There was an Iraqi uprising,
And they want to rein in our mercenary killers, you know, who we've hired. We said we sent so many troops home and that the war is ended, supposedly, or, military operations have ended. But we still have many, many, I call them mercenaries there. They are don't go by any rules at all except their own, and the people in Iraq are starting to rise up also. So it's a good sign, I think, and it's like I said, we need to learn a lesson from these people and follow their suit, I believe.
Well, I hope that that in Wisconsin that people stand strong.
I was delighted when I heard that the police union
joined that
crowd.
Yeah.
And they told him, or they don't work for him, but they work for the people, you know. And that was great. And but see, we just read this article just tonight about the censorship of that in the mainstream media.
Right.
They're not showing the Wisconsin
union people. They're not showing that there's like 100,000 people
right.
who've come out. It's only briefly mentioned, if mentioned at all, on CNN or MSNBC,
right.
and certainly not on Fox. And Fox is advocating and getting behind the governor. That governor has accepted a lot of money from
the Koch brothers.
From the Koch brothers, behind the Tea Party.
Right. So, you know, it's a big scam. And,
right.
And the contracts that he insists that they accept
are no bid contracts for power plants. And of course, the Koch brothers. That's where they're heavily tied up.
Yeah,
and
so the Koch brothers actually wrote this bill, you know, and want to receive all the benefits, including banging up and destroying the unions. So it's like,
And they can be bought so cheaply, $43,000, that's all it costs to buy that guy.
Yeah, really cheap. Yeah.
It's all it costs to buy Walker.
Yeah.
And then they donated some money to the Republican Governor's Fund and put on
$1 million.
Yeah, that's nothing.
These guys are multi-billionaires, okay? And
these guys are so cheap to buy.
You can buy your representative. You can buy Chris Murphy for $2,000.
Well,
yeah.
It seems that way, doesn't it?
kill your mother, Murphy. Here's $2,000. Yeah, okay. You know.
Better for fuel oil.
It's like these guys can be bought and sold so cheaply. It's just unbelievable. I don't know.
So let's get back to your rally, though. How many people do you think you might have a chance of turning out at that rally?
Right now we have at least 25 people, and it doesn't sound like a lot, but I know that we've been urging everybody to come and bring anybody that they can. So
I think you're
25
buy more
have
they,
committed to
they,
us.
That's
so far.
Just the people you contacted, not the people that have contacted the contacts to the contacts.
That's right.
And, and we're not expecting 100,000 people there. I mean, if we get 100 or 200 people, it would be amazing.
Right,
but
right.
You might be surprised, Lila. Lila can be so cynical.
Well, we learned. I mean, we were up there for 5 years, and there were times when there were only maybe 7 of us up there, you know? So it was a core group, but we kept at it. I'm sorry that we stopped. It was pretty bad timing to stop when Obama got elected, because we gave the impression that we really were supporting him, and, you know, we just walked away from the green at that point. I'm the first to admit that it was bad timing, and I just, we started in the winter of 2003, right before Bush was going, rattling his sabers to go into Iraq, and I felt like I just couldn't sit at home and watch this happen. I had to do something, and so, that's John and I decided, we heard about the, gatherings up on the green, and we decided to do that, and little did we know that, we were going to stay there for 5 years and participate in that. At that time, there were probably 50 to 60 people up there on the green every Sunday. But like
did
I said,
you go to the, did you go to the January 18th rally in 2003? That was before Bill and I were on the radio, but we went to Washington.
You went? Did you go down to Washington?
Oh no, I went to the one in New York City. That was probably in February sometime. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We went to the January. Eileen Landry was the and her husband were had set up that they were the
Imagine Peace. Did you ever meet them?
Oh yes, yeah. They're actually coming to the Green on March 20th.
Oh, good for them.
Oh, good.
Nice to see them. Because I know they kind of dropped out of it too. They got disgusted with the whole thing.
Right.
It's great that.
That you've energized people.
Yeah.
This is a great idea. And who else is supporting you by calling? You have other folks calling too?
Oh yeah, yeah. Dorothea and Mario are calling. A person named Liz Brancato, who was one of the regulars up there, is calling. You know, we've got quite a core group that is willing to, you know, get out there, and everybody is very, very enthusiastic about this. You know, we
that's all it takes. If you get, you know, 20 people, all right, really 20 people that are excited, they'll talk to 20 people who will talk to 20 more people, and that's how it gets viral, you know.
Well, I think it's great way to get people reinterested and recommitted to their core values.
Right, exactly. It's if I could read one more thing from this Chris Hedges thing, it really speaks to you were talking about, the media blackout. Just a short thing. It does not matter if this protest or any other does not work, and he's talking about this protest on March 20th. It does not matter if this protest or any other does not work. It does not matter if we are 500 or 50. It does not matter if the event is covered in the press or ignored. It matters only that those of us who believe in the rule of law, who find the organized sadism of war and militarism repugnant, and who seek to protect the sanctity of life, rise up. If we do not defend these virtues, they will be extinguished. So that's kind of how I, you know, have come to feel. For a while I felt that those 5 years on the Green were kind of wasted, but it's not wasted only if you look at it that way, I believe. You know, I think that, you know, we were an example to people to stand up and say no to war. And
time that was very difficult when you were called unpatriotic.
Right, right. Well, we were called a lot worse things than that, trust me. But you have to develop kind of a thick skin when you stand out there with a sign saying stop the war, and, you know, have people driving by with their, you know, big Range Rovers.
Do you remember Ziggy?
Oh yes, yes.
Ziggy the flag waver there?
Yes.
Oh, I wonder what he's doing.
I heard that he has become the darling of the Tea Party movement in Waterbury.
I could see that.
Yeah.
He's Ziggy jumping right into that. Yeah.
Right.
Well, so Ziggy used to be, he was from, I actually interviewed him once for our television show, and he was Ziggy's from Czechoslovakia or something.
Someplace in Eastern Europe.
He's a very
right.
strong accent in Eastern Europe. And I don't even know if he's an American citizen or not, but he's pro-American.
Right,
and
definitely.
And he was in a flag, and he has the American flag, and he stands on a street corner. And he was from Waterbury, Connecticut. And he would just go up and down the streets, okay, waving
the
flag. American flag. The guy was a complete lunatic. There's no
right.
doubt about it.
Right.
Crazier than hell. And he loved America, and he just
he found some vehicles to use that. And he found about what was happening on the Green, and he came up to protest the protesters.
Yep.
Exactly.
And he was the only guy across the street from 20 or 30 protesters on the Green.
Right.
And even that flag,
right.
He'd walk through the whole city of Waterbury, waving that flag down Main Street. Any given day of the week.
But what upset me about him was that he was saying that his kind of speaking out was the only kind of patriotism that there is.
Exactly.
And that's why I didn't care for his message. It was okay for him to wave the flag, but he was waving it at us when what we were doing was very American.
That's right, because he doesn't
understand what being an American really means or what that Constitution means.
That's right. He doesn't understand the freedom of speech that we have and the fact that it's patriotic to use it and to speak against our government. He would never speak against the government of the United States. And I guess I have to kind of respect him from where he comes from. He had a pretty hard life back. I don't know if it was Romania, somewhere in Eastern Europe, like you said.
Bach or someplace like that. I'm not really sure, but it was in the Iron Curtain. But Ziggy's one of a kind, and he makes absolutely no sense. And he's probably right at home with the Tea Party.
Right. Well, we actually are trying to get in touch with him to invite him back, because it wouldn't be a protest on the green without Ziggy there. So we'll have all sides anyway.
He's going to bring a bunch
he'll
of tea
He'll bring a busload of tea parties.
Yeah, maybe. Well, that doesn't scare us, to be honest with you. It really doesn't.
I understand that in a way. I understand that very much. To see what's going on with these, who's behind the Tea Party movement,
yes.
All right? To see that, and to see that mind wash kind of, brainwashing stupidity,
right.
It just is too much, too much to take.
Yeah.
And I swear, if you invite the Tea Party, all right, it's questionable if you'll get too many, old warriors,
Right. Well, we're not inviting the Tea Party per se. If they hear about it, that's fine.
Maybe that crazy bastard who used to ride around with the nuke Iraq bomb in the back of his truck. Maybe he'll come along.
Right.
Nuke Libya now or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, this is what you invite with those kind of crazies.
Yeah.
And, now Tea Party people are packing guns, too. So it's like, I don't know, Jan. Freedom of speech is great, but, within moderation, to the extent that if you're going to have a anti-war rally or a peace rally, you don't want guys infiltrating you or having across the street who are packing guns,
Yeah. I hear what you're saying.
What I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think I skip Ziggy, Ziggy's out of his freaking mind. I know because I interviewed him.
Yeah, we had many a conversation up there on the green, and, he is quite a character, that's for sure. I kind of
talked to him about 15 years ago, and he wasn't too lucid then.
Yeah.
But,
it was
more than that.
It was 2000.
Oh.
It was in 2000.
Okay.
We didn't even know each other 15 years ago.
Well, what was it? It's 2011 now. Yes. Okay. All
right.
It seems like a long time ago.
Yeah, we interviewed him in July 2000 at the fireworks at the stadium there.
Oh.
And he was waving the flag for Giordano. Okay, the mayor of
Waterbury, the one that was the child molester that
I couldn't stand the guy. Nobody in the state could stand the guy, and it turned out. Yeah.
Right after that, he was gone.
Yeah. It took him a year or so, but after that, he was found out that he was indicted on. He's serving 40 years in jail.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I mean, that's who Ziggy loved and admired
at that time. So he's probably moved on to somebody else. But the main part, though, is the interest of the fact that you have people coming to remind us that we're still in two wars, and according to some of the things that I've read, that we may be in a third war in Libya.
That's right. Not to
mention. And I think it's a very good time to get down there on the green and remind people about those things. And the fact that we're spending so much money on these wars, and so much money is being drained out of this country to the detriment of the people and to the detriment of the infrastructure of this country, which after this winter, I don't know what kind of condition it's going to be in, especially in New England.
Yeah.
We need that money to help our people and to have decent lives here in America.
Exactly.
So Jen, those are great words. Do you have anything else to say to the audience and how to end our interview?
Well, I know that you reach a broader audience than Northwest Connecticut, and I would totally urge anyone in Northwest Connecticut to come to the Green on Sunday, March 20th at 12 noon. We're at the top of the Litchfield Green. Come and stand in solidarity with us and let our elected officials know that we're holding them accountable for what is going on in our country and abroad, what they're doing with our tax dollars and with our soldiers' lives and our lives. And I know that there's a lot of people who are outside of this area, but I just urge everyone to do something on that day. That we're remembering 8 years. It's the 8-year anniversary of our involvement in Iraq. It's almost 10 years in Afghanistan. I just urge everyone to do something on that weekend, to call your representative or find another march or rally in your area and participate. It's not going to end until all the people rise up, just like they did in Egypt and Libya. And there is so much power in great numbers of people, and I would urge you to join a group anywhere and just participate in democracy and let your voice be heard.
Well, I think that's great, and I urge the same of all people in our area. And if you don't live in our area, start your own.
Or join us anyway. Take a plane. We're down, right down in Litchfield, Connecticut. Or join us right on the Green. Starts at noon, right?
Yeah, it starts at noon. That's right.
And ends whenever you want it to.
That's right. Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah, we will be there. And we thank you so much, Jen. Say hi to John, and we will be joining you then. And we will be talking to you before then, I'm sure.
That's great. And thank you for giving me a chance to talk about this tonight. And be well, both of you.
Okay, and thanks for being with us. Good night, Jan.
Good night.
And that was Gina Bonanuto, and now we're going to Woody in the Ring, but we have some music for him first. Let's play his music. Right up here.
Thank you, Lila. Great music and a stellar introduction. How's my connection this evening, by the way?
You sound nice and clear.
Oh, I do.
Can
That's
you hear
great.
Us?
Just fine, thank you. Wonders of the Internet.
Okay,
anyway,
great.
Thank you. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, the NBA, NFL news, and, of course, baseball. All right, let's get down to it. As I've said before, as a Chicago Bulls fan, I may hate the New York Knicks, but when the Knicks are relevant, the NBA benefits. How so, you may ask? Well, when Carmelo Anthony joined the New York Knicks, the NBA and its TV carriers finally have a draw in the United States' biggest TV market. Sunday's ESPN game versus the Miami Heat, which the Knicks thankfully won, It's not that I dislike the Heat so much. Can't stand the existence of that jerk LeBron James. Anyway, getting off topic, that game drew a 3.3 rating, which translates into 3.3% of households in the 56 urban TV markets measured. Now, that's up 175% from comparable coverage of a Miami-Orlando Magic game last year. It's also ESPN's highest regular season NBA rating in New York. So, you know, when a big market has a good team or an up-and-coming team, that translates into better games and more money. And isn't that what life is all about? One man may disagree with that statement, and that's Mike Bibby of the Washington Wizards. Now, the Washington Wizards and point guard Mike Bibby reached a buyout agreement, meaning the former Atlanta Hawk can sign with any team once he clears waivers. Players bought or waived before today's deadline are eligible to play in the postseason for their new teams. The idea of a buyout for Bibby, who played in two games for the Wizards, came immediately after Thursday's trade. Bibby, 32, was less than thrilled from going from a playoff team to a lottery team and will sacrifice the $6.2 million remaining on his contract for the 11-12 season to get out of Washington. Now, you got to like this guy. I liked him when he played out west for the Sacramento Kings. He was quite a baller then, but this is quite a move here. This guy would rather play for having a shot at winning a title and play for nothing than get paid $6.2 million and have absolutely no shot at all of winning a title. I mean, that's in today's world of me, and all that other jazz, I don't know, you really got to tip your cap to this guy. He just wants to win a ring, and I think that's great. And he's sacrificing $6.2 million in order to try and make that happen. Now, granted, I believe he's been paid through his career maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 million. But, hey, you know, $6.2 million, that's a lot more money than I'll ever see in my lifetime, and he's given it up in order to win a ring. So, still, you got to tip your cap to the guy, and that's pretty cool. On to the NFL. Two former NFC Pro Bowl players were cut today by their respective teams. Quentin Portis by the Washington Redskins. He finishes as the number two all-time rusher with 6,824 yards. Those are pretty good numbers considering the Washington Redskins were a team once known for taking pride in running football. Obviously, over the last few years, they've been known for having kind of an idiot owner and Snyder who pays a lot of money for guys that just don't end up producing. But Quentin Portis was kind of a class act, great running back, a tough position. And as I said, he finishes as the Washington Redskins' number two all-time rusher, and that's quite a feat in itself. My Chicago Bears released three-time Pro Bowl player Tommy Harris, tackle Tommy Harris. He'd been with the Bears since his career started in 04 and up to 07. Great production, but after he signed a four-year extension in 08, he just started to decline, and you know, he got into Lovie Smith's doghouse. That certainly didn't help matters, but you know, so he's gone. I doubt he's going to go anywhere else. He, you know, he's been a little bit of injury problems and weight problems as well, and I'd be surprised if we see him elsewhere on another team, but hey, you never know. Okay, it's crunch time for the NFL. And the union. At issue is whether the NFL Players Association will decertify before the collective bargain agreement expires, a move that would allow individual players to file antitrust suits against the league. Executive Director Damari Smith has left that option open. And while some labor groups question the strategy, the AFL-CIO seems to support it. They have a lot of different ways they're considering to get to that agreement, and that's certainly one of them, spokesman Josh Goldstein told DailyCaller.com in a story posted Monday on the NFL labor website. The goal here is to get the agreement done. Our goals of keeping union membership or affiliates of the AFL-CIO is secondary to making sure these cities and workers don't miss out on a season. While both sides have been prepared for a lockout, the next few days leave time for a settlement, and according to Minnesota Vikings linebacker Aaron Henderson, whose tweet asked, "Y'all think an agreement will be reached for the NFL?" A CPL's day before the headline, like Carmelo Anthony to the New York Knicks? Yeah, well, we'll see about that, Henderson. I certainly hope so for the NFL's sake. They make bucket loads of money on the games that are on TV, endorsements and everything else, and sponsors. I mean, It's just bad business for there to be no business. So I assume the NFL and the Players Association are going to get together and they're going to get things straightened out. But, I think it's going to be a little unpleasant before it gets done. And, you know, it's been a little unpleasant thus far, but I'm pretty sure they're going to get this deal done. They know that a lockout next season just doesn't work for anyone. But we'll see. Okay, a little bit of news relating to Lawrence Taylor. The alleged pimp charged with supplying an underage hooker to fallen New York Giants legend Lawrence Taylor called an audible in his court case yesterday. Rashid Davis fired his third lawyer after rejecting a sweetheart plea bargain for no more than 105 months in a slammer. If he goes to trial and is convicted, Davis could face life in prison. Davis, 37, was unhappy with the mouthpiece hired by his family, said Stephen Frankel, a stand-in lawyer, during a brief hearing in Manhattan federal court. Magistrate Judge Henry Pittman said the case would be reassigned to Davis's previous court-appointed counsel. That should make him real happy. Who replaced a public defender Davis also didn't like. Beautiful. The ex-con faced at least 10 years in prison and a maximum of life if convicted of pimping out a 16-year-old Bronx runaway, whom he allegedly beat to make her service Taylor in a Rockland County hotel last year. Now, Taylor has since pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charges in a no-jail plea bargain in January. Just an unpleasant story continuing on. Hopefully this will get settled and this guy will just take the deal and this will probably go away. And it's just another bump in the road there for Lawrence Taylor, whose life during and after football has just been crazy. It's too bad the guy was something else on the field, but he's also something else off the field. Kind of like Charlie Sheen a little bit there. With hookers and cocaine and everything else. But, hey, what are you going to do? To each his own. Moving forward to baseball. And we're going to start with two Red Sox stories. Yes, two Red Sox stories. The first is a continuation of a story I got last year. It's with Big Poppy and hip-hop superstar Jay-Z. Now, slugger David Ortiz will Jay-Z will face off in court this month if they can't resolve their cyber-squatting dispute. After 3 hours of negotiations yesterday, Manhattan federal judge Richard Berman said it was clear that reps for both men do not have the authority to settle the East Coast rivalry. Jay-Z is suing Big Poppy for using the website to promote his Dominican nightclub 4040, which he calls a ripoff of his famed 4040 club. Now, to a layman, obviously it seems like a ripoff. Jay-Z's club in New York City and I think a couple other cities is named 4040, and Big Fatty or Big Poppy, whatever he's going by, has named his club 4040, and it's down in the Dominican Republic, and, you know, he thinks nobody will know the difference. Much like he doesn't know the difference between a fastball and a curveball. But anyway, neither side would say how much Jay-Z wants, but Big Poppy's business manager, Mark Walker, called it way too much. Frankly, I think Big Poppy's totally in the wrong. I mean, it's obvious what he did was just it's a way to grab Jay-Z's business on the internet. The cyber squatting thing is he's acting like he's 4040 Club, whereas Jay-Z isn't. It's just really some dirty pool in order to get business going his way. Certainly doesn't surprise me. Big Poppy's a bit of an idiot. So we'll see how that pans out. Hopefully it comes out of his pocketbook, which would be nice, and he can just return to the buffet line. Anyway, another Red Sox story, which was kind of interesting. Boston Red Sox right-hand pitcher Josh Beckett has a mild concussion symptoms after he was hit in the back of the head during a batting practice before against the Minnesota Twins. Beckett walked from the field on his own with trainers at his side, but after being examined by a doctor, he was sent home to rest. The Red Sox expect an update on Beckett probably today or later today. It is believed he was hit by a ball beheaded by coaching staff assistant Eno Guerrero, who was hitting balls from the outfield back to the bucket near second base. Oof, bad luck for Beckett. Beckett is coming off an injury-riddled 6-6 season in which he had a 5.78 ERA. To me, this doesn't bode well for Beckett. I know it's just a head injury and it's a mild concussion, but I just think it doesn't bode well for his season. I think he's kind of been snake bit since the Red Sox won the World Series and he pitched and he was injured. He just hasn't been the same since. And I certainly don't think this is a good way for him to start the season off with his mild concussion thing. I realize it's only a mild concussion, but if it's not one thing, it's another with this guy. I was very surprised when the Red Sox gave him a large contract extension. Usually with guys like this, they just kind of get rid of. I mean, that's the Red Sox way. They have no problem riding their stars on a rail out of town. This wasn't the case with Beckett. I was just very surprised. I just don't see good things in his future. You may say, well, that's because you're a Yankee fan, but not really. As I said, his production has gone down since that World Series, and he pitched when he was injured. If you look at the numbers, you'll find that that's true. And I just don't think this is a good way for him to get started this new season. And I think it's just going to just be a continuation of more things to come. Okay, moving forward. Carlos Beltran of the New York Mets is no longer center of attention. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Carlos Beltran swallowed his pride yesterday and effectively told the world he prefers the title Mr. Met over center fielder. The Mets center field controversy, if you could call it that, ended with Beltran marching into the manager's office around 7:30 a.m. to tell manager Terry Collins he wants to play right field this season. Angel Pagan will be the Mets' starting center fielder. Collins said he breathed a sigh of relief that Beltran handled the situation with class. The manager said he thought Beltran might attempt to play several games in center field this spring. If not, he declared he wanted to remain in the position all season, regardless of how his knee felt. You're hoping and praying it goes like this, Collins said. You're hoping your star walks in and says, this is what's best for the team at this particular moment, and you'll have no problem with me. Now let's get ready to play. That's what you're hoping for. But you've got to get ready for them to say, no, I'm the center fielder here. From the first day on, he's treated it right, and when he said yesterday morning that he wanted to talk, I wasn't sure what it was about. He walked in and told me, I said, you're a pro. You're thinking about the team first. You're a pro. You got to like this from Beltran. He realizes, you know, his knee definitely isn't what it used to be. I also think he realizes that, you know, in order for him to get his numbers up in it, and his numbers need to be somewhat up, I believe his contract ends at the end of this year. I think it's pretty obvious that the Mets are going to shop him rather hard before the break, so he doesn't need any setbacks. And, you know, a setback could be, you know, something bad happening to center field to that knee of his. I think it's a pretty shrewd move by him. Apparently he consulted with his former teammate, Carlos Delgado, and obviously his super agent, Scott Boras. So not surprising he made the move. It's definitely a smart move on his part, very shrewd. He definitely probably wants to get out of the Mets. I would too. So we'll see what happens, you know, at the break. Maybe his numbers are up and he can get a ticket out of there. So speaking of tickets and getting out of there and making things different, two guys from the New York Yankees had rough seasons last year. Not just two guys, but I'm going to talk about Derek Jeter and Mark Teixeira. They had rough years at the plate. Jeter's made some changes. You know, they're coming along. I don't think he's absolutely comfortable yet. A lot of it has to do with the movement of his leg and some timing. So he's adjusting. He's got a new swing that he's working on. The hitting coach, Long, you know, he has a reputation as a master fixer, and it will certainly be tested on several fronts during this process. First, you know, he's working with Jeter, and when Jeter sneezes, there's a chance, you know, it'll land on the front pages. Jeter's coming off a career low 270 average. He'll be 37 in June, and is 74 hits away from his 3,000 hits. Not to mention, as a leadoff hitter, his job is to ignite a lineup that will be expected to compensate for a starting rotation loaded with questions. Second, everything about what is happening with Jeter's left foot is foreign. Late last year, Jeter cut down on his stride, but didn't keep his foot in contact with the dirt. Now he's supposed to pivot his foot, but never let it leave the ground. Yesterday in Jeter's last at bat, Long noticed space between the shortstop's cleats and the batter's box. According to Long, you know, he feels for Jeter because he hasn't done it enough times. He's not discouraged. He's looking forward to getting it right, and I'm certainly not ready to cash it in. According to Girardi, he's not going to assess Jeter until March 31st to see if his new swing is, you know, making progress. You know, from what everyone knows, Jeter's quite a hard worker. He wants to get things right. Jeter wants to be Mr. New York Yankee, and I can assure you that he'll be working his butt off in order to get that swing in order. You know, Jeter is Jeter. The guy's a hard worker. You got to appreciate that. I don't think Father Time is scraping in. I just think, you know, he's got to make a few maneuvers that are going to help that swing out. Got to have less movement. It gives you less movement before the pitch gets there. It gives you more time to think about swinging. You know, that's basically what it is. And as if it's not hard enough to hit a baseball. Remember, guys are rewarded for failing in baseball. If you hit 300, you're doing awesome. And that's only 3 out of 10. Those numbers are failing. In any other sport, you'd be like, wow, that's horrible. But in baseball, you're like, man, that's great. So just try and keep that in mind. Another guy that had a tough season last year, Mark Teixeira. He had a very poor start in May. I think he was batting 138 or something, whatever. And it really took, like, all season for him to come around. It was just a really uphill battle. He's been a creature of habit when it comes to spring training. Last year, he had to wait very hard. He thinks maybe that made his swing more difficult. He felt a little more bulky. A lot of times last year when he had extra time, he was running into the weight room. This year, he switched it up a little bit. Now when he has free time, he's going to the batter's box. So he's hoping to put an end to this poor spring training stuff and a slow start. You know, even though he's always recovered from a slow start, although last year, not so much. I mean, he did recover, but not so much. But he's always recovered, but I think he's sick of trying to recover. I think he wants to have a good season throughout the season, not just like maybe a great season like towards the end of the season. I think he wants to be good throughout. And another guy that you can be sure is going to work hard to try and make that happen is Mark Teixeira. So he and Jeter, I'm sure, are working quite hard. They want to be successful, and I'm pretty sure they're going to be. So we'll just have to wait and see. Before I close, I just want to speak a little bit about something that I saw on current TV. And I'm actually chasing this girl down. I'm going to try and get a pretty cool interview for you guys. The thing that was on current TV was called 20 Seconds of Joy. It was about this base jumper, a Norwegian female base jumper. And she ends up having an accident and isn't able to base jump anymore. But the sport looked really cool to me. And it was on for an hour and a half. It's on current TV. I thought it was very interesting. I'm going to try and get an interview with this girl, so I'm chasing her down. And hopefully by next week or the following week, I'm going to have her on, and I think it's going to be a pretty good interview. So you can stay tuned for that in the near future. Okay, that's it for me. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy. Until next week, warm weather's coming. Thank you so much.
Blues.
Yeah.
I hope you folks enjoyed it as much as we did. Those were two songs that Leo picked.
Well, they were. You got to remember too, they're non-copyrighted songs that production actually non-copyrighted tunes, so they're permissible to play on
radio shows. Unless you're on a big station that
has a license,
you can't. There is a lot of music you simply just can't use. And we couldn't use our original...
I'm glad you enjoyed the ones we did have.
Opening music that we used to have on our show, FM show in Lakeville. We can't play that because we don't have a license. So we picked some different songs out, and we were enjoying them.
What I wanted to... what we're going to do now, and our last segment for the night... We usually have John Brennan, our environmental
chemtrail
reporter, and chemtrail keeps us updated on chemtrail activities and so on. But we have a special segment tonight. I'm going to play several short clips from the Belfort Group Chemtrail Symposium that took place back in May of this year, of last year, and in Belgium, and
May 2010, yeah.
Where did you see? This particular one is quite. What can I say? This is quite touching. As an introduction, this is by a young woman. She's 17 years old, and her name is Sofia Zanidez. And she will talk about her experience and her learning about chemtrails and through her mother and others, and its effect on her. And then we'll go into the symposium. But this is she. Presented this at the symposium.
Okay. So
and,
let's hear what she has to say.
And so this is Sofia Zanidez
commenting on chemtrails
from the Belfort Group Chemtrail Symposium.
Thank you, Peter. Hi, everybody. Good afternoon. Guten Abend. Guten Tag. Bon après-midi. Kalimera, good day. My name is Sofia Xenidis. I am 17 years old. My father is Greek. My mother is German, Maria Schneider. And I myself have the Belgian nationality. At school, I'm studying human science, and I was asked to share with you how I met the Belfort Group and how I became interested in chemtrails. I first heard about the Belfort Group through my mother. She had discovered the Project Camelot website and was specifically searching for like-minded people here in Belgium. Bill Ryan pointed her to the Belfort Group. Then one Thursday evening in February this year, we decided to watch a video clip where Peter Vreeke was being interviewed about chemtrails. Until then, we had never paid attention to those white cloud lines in the sky. The next day at school, I happened to look out of the window when I noticed four airplanes fly over our town, spraying a chessboard pattern of chemtrails, one thick line neatly next to the other. I was shocked to realize that what I had seen in the video clip was really going on right here and now, above my own head. After school, I went straight home. I was in a state of panic and shock and could not stop crying. I felt so threatened and helpless. My mother then proposed to attend an open meeting that the Belfort Group happened to have the next day, and by coincidence, right on the issue of chemtrails, so that we could learn more and meet these people. We did go to the meeting, and this is how we came to be involved with the Belfort team. Since then, there is hardly a day that I do not see at least some of those airplanes. They almost always fly when the sky is clear and blue. And the day after, it very often rains or the sky is completely covered with a thick layer of clouds with no sun coming through. There are also days when it looks like an intense military offensive is taking place, and when I can observe hundreds of aircraft passing overhead the whole day long, from early in the morning right through into the night, when they still keep flying, even in the dark, and I can see the white lines under the moonlight. It is quite scary to know that the air we breathe is not what it's supposed to be, that the food we eat and the water we drink contain traces of those substances which are sprayed out over all of us as though we were being poisoned like insects. The feeling that this is causing me are feelings of deep anger and rage. I don't want to be poisoned. I don't want to have been infected with cancer. And I'm just so angry that this global poisoning can be going on such a massive scale, and not enough is being done to stop this crime. I find that many more people need to be alerted to what is going on. Everybody must wake up and start protesting against it. This is the reason why I actively use my own social contacts and internet to post information or video clips specifically on chemtrails, but also on many other issues of injustice in this world. I consider myself a representative of my own generation, and even though I don't know other teenagers yet who are equally awake, I certainly hope that many others will have their eyes opened. The point is that we need to unite forces in order to fight against this injustice. And this is just exactly the reason why we have come together here today from various European countries as well from overseas to unite our forces and to force change. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your kind attention.
That was Sofia Zanintes from Greece speaking at the symposium. And the next one I have is from the same symposium, but hang on one second here. Hopefully I got the right one.
She's actually she's a Belgian citizen. Her mother's German and her father is Greek.
My mistake.
And she sees those chemtrails where she is, just like we do here. It's a worldwide thing. It's not just here in the United States. It's everywhere.
Right.
And many of us share her rage that it's being done to us without our consent. So which
I'm
one are you going
to
play?
I'm looking for it here. But just fix one second here. So.
Yeah.
Hang on one second.
For the next segment that he wanted to play.
Yeah.
So.
Maybe I'll play this one.
See what this one is.
And this is one of the guest speakers there, and he's an American, but I believe this one is okay. I'm going to check this one. It's not the exact clip that I had, but...
I thought you put it.
I always love that.
I did, but not this particular one.
Thank you, and I think we owe a big applause for Paul Wittenberger, who and that was actually the first film that Paul and I did. So we went out, we shot one day, and didn't know much about the subject at the time, and we'll get into some other films. But, you know, this guy's amazing because 3 days later, he puts this film out, and then my phone's ringing off the hook. They go, oh, my God, you did a fantastic film. So I think that film was really effective in just waking people up and to get them aware of the issue, and that's really where we were when we had filmed that. But as many of us know in the room today, this issue goes much more deeper. And when we had done that project, it was, like I said, it was just a project. It wasn't, we didn't have an agenda to do a documentary. But the story for for me, got really interested, and I have dedicated my life to this issue because obviously I was concerned about the issue, but I had learned about the American Association for the Advancement of Science meeting, which was held in San Diego on, I believe it was February 20th or February 22nd. So I went in as a reporter, and they're probably not too happy about that because we spilled the beans on the aluminum. But anyways, went in as a reporter, and for an entire day, I had listened to geoengineers talk about their plans to spray aerosols, aluminum and barium, up to 10 to 20 million tons of aluminum and barium into the sky for the stated goal of cooling the planet. And it really blew my mind. And David Keith was one of the speakers. Ken Caldera was another speaker. But at the time, I still was not aware of how damaging aluminum was. So one of the Dane Wigington, who will be in the next video, he had asked David Keith, after they had proposed these models, he said, "Well, Mr. Keith, what health effects, implications, and environmental implications would dumping 10 to 20 million tons of aluminum into the atmosphere have?" And David Keith responded by saying, "Well, we've done a ton of research on sulfur, and sulfur doesn't have that much of an impact." And Dane said, "I'm not talking about sulfur." He said, "I am talking about aluminum." And David Keith, his eyes just bulged out, and he said, "Well, aluminum, we haven't done much, and we could find something terrible tomorrow that we don't know about. But the aluminum was the key on this issue, because what I had learned during this meeting, Dane pulled me aside, and he said, hey, I want to talk to you about what we're finding in massive amounts in Northern California and people are finding around the world." And they are. They're finding massive amounts of aluminum, barium, strontium in the rain, snow, and soil. So that's really what kicked off the documentary. I wanted to look further in this. So they sent me a ticket. I got a film crew, and I flew up to Northern California. And what I found saddened me, and it blew my mind. So the first stop, essentially, was Dane Wigington's property, and Dane had told me everything is dying on my property. And Dane moved up to the Mount Shasta area, which is far removed from anything. It's one of the most beautiful areas in Northern California, known for its forestry. And Mount Shasta itself should be one of the cleanest areas in the world. With that being said, Dane moved up there to get away from the California pollution and everything, but now everything started dying on his property, so we investigated a little bit, and I guess how it started with him, he noticed his trees were dying, the amphibians were dying, there were less bugs, less crickets and everything, his grass was not growing, so he decided to take a soil test, and when he did take a pH soil test, he found alarming levels. At the very minimum, the soil was 10 times the amount of its normal alkalinity. And I think many people in the room know that many plants and many trees need an acidic soil to grow. So that's what he believes everything is dying from. What he did, he went and did additional tests. So Dane showed me around his property, and he works for Bechtel for a number of years. He's an expert on solar power. During this time, with the aerosol spraying, he has noticed up to a 60% decline in his solar power. He's also done tests on the solar panels, which have revealed very high levels of aluminum and barium. But the most revealing test is what he did. Again, he has 2,000 acres. So Dane builds ponds, about 50 yards, I mean, just massive ponds. So he filled it up with water, and he tested the water and had the normal amounts of aluminum because it was fresh, no barium, but it had about 5 or 7 parts per billion, which is normal. A year and a half later, after what he believes is heavy aerosol spraying, he found alarming rates. Again, 7 parts per billion should be normal, and I just want somebody in the audience to take a guess at the level that they found, unless it's a person that took some of my tests that I had out. 100? That would seem very high. Anybody else?
300.
What was that?
We know.
You guys, okay, no cheating. Somebody from the back, just throw out a number of the alarming range.
81,000.
1,000, and 1,000 would be massive amounts. You guys are not going to believe this. The levels that he found from his water test were 375,000 parts per billion.
Wow.
That's why we're getting chemtrailed to death.
It's killing people.
This is part five of this, and this is the follow-up.
Literally toxic water. So there's definitely a concern. I'm not sure offhand what the barium levels were. If somebody has the test that I had put up there, you can let us know. There are massive amounts. Now, Northern California is up in the jet stream area, and they get hit very hard. They believe they're getting hit real hard because of the massive strains in the jet stream. So they think that for some reason they're spraying to get that into the jet stream. But I left Dane's property just heartbroken because of what I had learned. But I also left his property with a passion. So my next step of the day, I spent an entire day with a retired soil biologist who worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. His name is Francis Mangles, who will be on the video as well. And Francis took me around the town of Mount Shasta, where he's deeply concerned. The area, in that area, they have a salmon run every spring. And I remember as a kid seeing pictures of literally millions of salmon that were running up the river. That salmon run is almost non-existent today because in the past 7 years, the salmon run has declined 94%. So they have just 6% of the salmon run, which I asked Francis why he believes that is occurring from his professional opinion. He took me out to a stream, and we did a test in the stream, and it was a bug test. And normally, he told me 10 years ago, the test that we performed yielded about 1,000 bugs. When we went out there, and this is on the film, it yielded just 36. The few fish that Francis has caught, because he fishes a lot, he's cut them open. He said they're starving to death. There's nothing in their stomach. He believes that the decline in the bugs is due to the ecological change of what's getting into the water. I said, what have you noticed? What's different 10 years ago? He said, the only difference I know are the massive amounts of aluminum, barium, and strontium that we're finding. And he also took me around Mount Shasta and showed me the alarming changes in the pH. And at the bare minimum, it was over 10 times the normal alkalinity, up to somewhere around 20 times the alkalinity. Write his number down. He's welcome. He said that you're welcome to give him a call if you have any of my articles. His email is on there. I encourage all of you, please, we got to work together to talk to the scientists and to get this information. Snow test on Mount Shasta. People come to Mount Shasta to climb from all around the world, and it's far removed from any industry. And again, a snow test was taken from Mount Shasta. Normal aluminum levels should be 7 parts per billion. And I guess I can't shock you guys with this because it was a little bit lower, but they did find massive amounts of aluminum, 61,100 parts per billion in the snow. People come from around the world to climb that mountain. They hydrate themselves with the snow. It's toxic. It's literally toxic. So our message is very simple within the film. And what I had learned, geoengineers are proposing spraying aluminum, barium, and strontium. The Hughes aircraft pattern calls for the disbursement of those aerosols, and what's being found in massive amounts in the rain, water, and soil is aluminum, barium, and strontium. They have seen a correlation because they test the rain quite a bit, and I hope to encourage many people here to test the rain. They have seen a correlation when the spraying seems to subside, the aluminum, the barium greatly falls. But when they spray real heavy and they do the rain test, those numbers go skyrocket. So many people are deeply concerned about this. And during that trip, I also, I guess we'll talk about this right now. During that trip, I also have an organic farmer, a friend who builds organic farms. And over the past 5 years, according to him, they've seen a great decline in the organic farms. And I'm not making a statement here, but I'm asking a deep question. Well, I am making a statement, but I'm also going to pose a question. Organic farms are dying or starting to see a die-off. The effective, successful farms have a new aluminum-resistant GMO seed. I'm going to say that one more time. Natural things are starting to see a die-off. Aluminum-resistant GMO seeds are starting to grow effective. And when we came back from our trip from Hawaii, many people are deeply concerned because they are spraying offshore that this could be, and as scary as it sounds, a lot of people said, you know, we're a little concerned that maybe part of this agenda could be to kill off anything that's natural and organic and re-engineer it so that people have to go to company XYZ for perhaps a license to grow their own food in their backyard. So this is very frightening and very scary stuff, and I think my greatest hope today is to ask some questions and to put in your mind, let's ask some questions, let's research this. I really think we're in a major crisis. So with that being said, I don't want to talk too much because I want to get into my next film. I promised Paul I would let him know. Paul did not cut this film. This was part of my California trip, so it's not the production quality for what we do, but it does have a lot of incredible and great information on it. So without speaking any further, and then afterwards, please write down questions. I would like some dialogue. I want to hear what your thoughts are, and I can only share what I've learned along my way, okay?
He's showing I think I'm going to skip through this because I got one more segment I want to say, and I'm going to recommend that you go to YouTube, all right, and look up Chemtrails First Installment Symposium Belgium 5. This particular one is number 5 of 21. There's actually 21 segments to this symposium. But if you just go to Chemtrails Belgium Symposium, it'll bring you to this. And I'm going to, one more I have before tonight is done. I just wanted to, this is a scientist, a professor who is going to explain an actual report, okay, that they did. And this is about 8 or 9 minutes long.
So far, the clips have been very interesting.
Yeah, they really spell it out, right? And
our next speaker has a really, really hard task. We asked him to review our report. Now, this report, I will tell you, is more than 300 pages, and it's completely based on scientific evidence and data. It's very important. It's a masterpiece. It's been made by a number of people who put a very large amount of effort and time into it. Anyone here in the audience who wants to have a copy of this report, listen very carefully, can have it for free. Yes, because we want this report to be spread as far and as wide as possible. Therefore, we will give it. give it to you if you ask for it. So, where was I? Well, this report has as a goal to show beyond any doubt that those innocent trails of frozen water vapor do contain a little more than just water vapor. On behalf of the Belfort Group, by the way, and of all humanity, we would like to congratulate and thank the international team responsible for this report and for the scientific evidence-based and very well-documented continents. Reading this report and reviewing it, we needed to find an academic of undisputed reputation, familiar with the subject and the problematics, and especially willing to comment freely and objectively in a critical way. I believe that you understand how difficult it is to find such a person. You will therefore also understand how delighted and grateful we are to introduce this expert in aviation and space technology from the Technische Universiteit Delft in the Netherlands. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Koen Vermeeren.
Thank you very much. It's an honor for me to be here with so many of you. A few weeks ago, Peter Dreger asked me to review this 300 or more page report. And of course, first I declined because I said, well, I'm not an expert. And then he said, well, there are no experts, basically, not in the open at least. And because I tend to be a bit open-minded. I am not here on behalf of our university, but I do work there as an aerospace engineer. So at least the trailing business is part of my space, my workspace. But I also organize a lot of lectures out of the box for the Delft University, and, well, this is typically out of the box. So I said, okay, I will do it. I'm going to sit down because I have to do a lot of reading. This is scientific stuff, so that means 300 pages. I won't give them to you, but I will give you some of the pages. And it asked me to be as objective as possible. I think that is an impossibility because you can never be objective about anything, but I will try to be as much as I can. It is not that I was unfamiliar with the chemtrail discussion, because we have a lot of first-year students in Delft studying aeronautical engineering, about 500 a year, so that's a lot. And there are always maybe between 5 to 15 students who ask questions to teachers. And at first you think, well, okay, it's quite normal, and then you start thinking about it again, and it seems to be more difficult than at first sight. Okay, so this is the report, Case Orange it is called, for reasons that I will come back to you on. Contrail science, its impact on climate and weather manipulation programs conducted by the United States and its allies. The authors are unknown. That is always a bit dubious, as you can understand, because, well, you cannot talk to the scientists involved, and that makes this quite a special job. The introduction and the evaluation of the report are on my account. The rest of the 5 chapters are from this report by the unknown authors. Let's start with the introduction. We heard it today already a few times. We have got shifting baselines. That means that I'm of another generation, and many of you are, that remember that there are blue skies. Every now and then you could see an aircraft with a trail, which we find quite normal. But usually people are with their heads to the ground in their own two-dimensional space, and they don't look up. But if you do, you see more and more spaces like this. And it worried me too. I have no explanations to our students about these phenomena. So that is important to realize. Well, this, of course, you all know. If you look at them from a scientific point of view, the first thing a scientist does is trying to explain something. Because I'm smart and my students are not as smart yet, so I have to give them answers to questions. But if you ask most scientists, honestly, they cannot answer all your questions. keep in mind. So, this looks normal. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. On the internet, there's a lot of discussion, and you all recognize these pictures. By the way, I cannot say that there are toxins in these barrels. That's not what I've investigated. I do know from experience that these barrels are used for shifting water down the plane in test flights to simulate movements of the center of gravity around the aircraft to for control and steering testing. So that's quite normal. This is not a conspiracy, in all cases at least. So if you look at these contrails, of course we live in a world of Photoshop. As an expert, I cannot say that these things are wrong. If I see them myself, then I am a first-hand eyewitness. I can say something about it. But it is not normal. What you see here is absolutely not as it should be. The same goes for this pattern here, which was seen above the Netherlands, and not only the Netherlands, of course, we've seen many pictures already, also above the Northern Netherlands a few weeks ago, and they are often explained as holding patterns. Well, holding patterns are given to aircraft who have to hold before they can land. Well, in this part of the country, we cannot have this many aircraft holding, and especially on the altitudes that they are holding, you should not be able to see chemtrails in a perfectly blue sky. So these are strange phenomena as well. Okay, that in mind, I'm going to the report, and the report is divided in a few chapters, as you can see here. We'll go through them all. Contrails, then. We have known them ever since men started to fly at high altitude. And this picture here is famous for the B-17 bombers in the Second World War. And they didn't like it. The pilots didn't like these trails because they made enemy fighters gave enemy fighters an easier job to track them down. So they didn't like that. The question that came to my mind immediately, what is a persistent contrail? Is that based on its length, and sometimes the report says between 20 to 30 miles, based on time, from seconds to minutes, or maybe even to hours, or based on the dimensions, so not only the length of the contrail, but also, after a few hours, the width of the contrail. So if you want to discuss this in a scientific way, you will have to set up standards to discuss this. Contrails are a difficult phenomenon. We saw that from the previous speaker as well. We don't really know that much about them, at least not in the open debate. So.
Okay, I'm going to leave it at that because we're at the end of the show.
I thought we were kind of left there, and I think if you felt like I do, you can go into YouTube.
Please go to Chemtrails Symposium Belgium.
The Belfort.
Belfort
Symposium.
And that particular one was number 9 of 21.
You can go
down through them all. They're fascinating and just absolutely amazing. I highly recommend them. Again, YouTube and Comtrails Symposium Belgium. Our time is up. We're not streaming anymore, but I wanted to, for those of you who are listening to this on the archives, I want you to know that I hope you got something out of this, and please, if you're listening to this segment, check out the chemtrail issue. And
we thank you for listening
to
us, and I hope you enjoyed our interview with Janice Bonanuto. And don't forget March 20th, 12 noon, which is a Sunday. It's Litchfield Green.
And if you wanted more information about it or directions, you can always email me at lasteeltv@yahoo.com, and I'll be happy to respond to you if you're interested in taking part or just having some information.
Or if you're not living nearby, you should start your own.
Start your own, very easy to do.
Get a bunch of your friends together. Get out on Sunday.
If you're by yourself, it's
hold a sign up.
Be brave and do it.
Remind people about the war.
So thank you for listening. Oh, join me tomorrow night as we venture into the fourth dimension. And on Friday night, we will have George Dixon joining us right here at 8 o'clock. So, tomorrow. Today's Tuesday. So tomorrow was when Lila and I will be here tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
We will be doing more news and reviews and stuff.
And then Thursday you'll be at
Thursday
the fourth dimension.
I'm already
Friday
there. I'm a day ahead of myself. So Thursday will be fourth dimensional
discussion
and Friday with George Dixon. So I hope you enjoyed the show.
And have a good night, folks.
Have a good night. We got a new ending song.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's not that one.
Oh, Leo didn't tell me.
Swagger.
Oh, sorry about that, folks.
It's all right. It's a little boozy. Goodbye.